Hey, everybody. Welcome to Crew Call with Mike Rose, Volume 1-4. This is going to be the last one in Volume 1 because I'm going to have Volume 1 be the first year and Volume 2 be the second year. So we've done 4 this year, and that's 4 more than 0. Anyway, my compatriot this time is my good friend Ken Karlowitz, the man, the myth, the legend. We're going to get to know Ken a little bit. He's got a lot going on, and actually Ken's got so much going on that we may need to talk to him more than once, but that's what Crew Call is all about, what's happening now. So welcome, Ken. Glad to have you aboard.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you think that I have so much going on. I'm just honored to be here, and I'm delighted to hear the latest news on myself. So, sure.
Anybody that knows you have a lot going on. And you know what? All of us have a lot going on. So that's why people like to listen to us talk about it, right?
That's why we're all good friends, because we're all up to something, right?
It's that birds of a feather thing, you know? Yeah, so I guess it might be useful for anybody who doesn't know who Ken Karlowitz is to know what Ken Karlowitz's background is. And I know that you're probably best known to the people at large as a photographer. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the magazine you used to publish and just a little bit about your background in photography, and then we can kind of go on to the next thing.
I actually just put up today one of my very first slides from like the first 4 rolls of Kodachrome that I shot in 1985. I was up at Starooka, actually, up on the Penn Division with a friend, and that was during the, during the detour.
Yes.
And someone turned me on to Rail Pace News Magazine. I saw the pictures of the Susquehanna trains running through Suffern, which is about 10 minutes from my house. And they said, well, you know, if you shoot slides instead of print film, you know, you send it into Tom Nemeth, you can get your picture, you know, in the magazine. Well, that's all you had to tell me, because I was up for that. So
that's how you got started. I don't think I even knew that myself.
Yeah, I mean, I shot pictures before that, but I never shot a roll of slides before. I was always shooting print film.
Sure.
And I had
must have a drawer full of interesting prints too.
Yeah, I shot a lot of film over the years, but basically what happened was that I started shooting trains within a couple of weeks of getting that news. I was up in a tree up at Bear Mountain. I shot a picture of an Amtrak train going over the wooden trestle at Iona Island.
Sure.
Only guy who got the shot naturally, and sent it in, and boom, it was a third of a page in the next issue.
Wow. The following What year do you think that was, Ken, roughly?
That was probably the end of 85, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think I had told you that I was going back through some old Rail Paces, just looking for pictures that were pertinent to my early 80s modeling period. And of course, I don't think I started subscribing to Rail Pace until maybe the late 80s or right around 90. So I was looking through our buddy Dave's old magazines, and Ken Karlowitz is like all over these Rail Paces. It should have been called Ken Pace.
Oh man, Keeping Pace with Ken is what they should have changed.
There you go.
Changed it, man. Yeah,
you were a photographer long before this, right? You've been a photographer your whole life.
My dad gave me a camera when I was 9 years old. And I was always the only kid that I knew, the only guy that I knew that had a camera. I signed up my dad for the Bell and Howell movie outfit, much to his surprise when it all arrived in a little kit with the projector. And you know, you got to pay so much a month, but he wasn't expecting that. But I signed up as Stanley Karlowitz, and there was the film thing. So during my teenage years, I mean, we were out in the backyard making karate movies and taking the camera to the tournaments, and I was like the crew photographer. I was the videographer and the photographer, but I really didn't become serious. I really didn't get serious about photography until till railroad photography is actually, I always tell friends and clients that I became a serious photographer from shooting railroads. And
interesting.
I started that at that time, of course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I moved away within a certain, probably by 1990, I went through a divorce. We all know what that's like.
Sure.
Some of us do.
Half of us do.
Right? About half. And I got into other genres of photography. I went to the International Center for Photography. I studied with some of the really great, master photographers of the time. And I was studying, basically I was involved in the pursuit of storytelling with pictures.
Okay.
And I had a client whose name was John Derniak, who used to be the picture editor at Look magazine. So I had this man coming out with me looking through my viewfinder, actually looking through the viewfinder and saying, I know what you're trying to say, but you're not quite getting it. The picture isn't really saying anything yet, but you're on to something. And before,
so he's teaching you not only composition but storytelling.
Yeah, he is actually coaching me. He's mentoring me on what it is that tells a story. And I remember someone gave me a book for Christmas one year called The Professional Photographer's Survival Guide, and in it was a chapter by John Derniak. And I remember I asked him to sign it for me, and he wrote, let the picture tell the viewer why you took it.
That's great.
Really, really has been, it's just been embedded in my psyche ever since then. It's like,
that's
first of
what's
all,
wrong with my photography. I don't know what the heck I'm trying to say.
Well, no, it's actually right on point. And the thing is, it's not just what you want to say. Maybe you don't really know what you want to say, but maybe you have an idea that there's something out there in that frame that you're going to take a picture of, but you're not sure what it is. Well, if you're not sure what the subject is and what you want me to look at, then how do I know what to look at? And
chances are, you're not either. Yeah.
You know, it's like a railroad that has all that spaghetti bowl effect where everything is just going, and there's the pickle factory and the gruesome casket and there's sidings off of sidings, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Where am I supposed to, what do you want me to do here? Where do you want me to look? What do you want me to focus on? There has to be a focal point, right?
I think everybody made a gruesome casket company. I know I enjoyed making that kid. I'll bet if I scrounged around under the layout someplace, I'll bet I could find remnants of that.
I still have mine in the basement on my practice 4x8 layout. It is still, I swear, I'm going to take a picture of it now that we've had this talk, and I'm going to post it up on my FB, and there it'll be living.
Yeah, throw that on Crew Call because it'll tie in with what we're talking about. I want to see it. I want to see it too.
Yep.
So at what point in this whole timeline do you decide, hey, I'm going to publish my own magazine?
Okay. Well, a buddy of mine, George Poval, who I met Trackside, and I, we kind of palled around a lot and chased a lot together, and we used to go to Vermont and stuff, and we would literally, we'd go to New England, and we'd find ourselves in some kind of a situation. We did a story called The Clash of Seasons one time. We went up to shoot peak fall foliage, got to Albany, run into a blinding snowstorm, and 10 hours later, we arrived at Montpelier, Vermont, and we were, I think we were slated to shoot the CV or something the next day, but, you know, ended up shooting three or four or five railroads. I may be confusing this with a story called Marathon Monday, but same concept. But literally on the way driving home, you know, we're talking about the story, and he's like, hold on, say that again. And he's writing it all down. He's got the dome light on in the car. And so what happened was we just kind of outgrew, I think that and Tom Nemeth, thank you, Tom, was absolutely great with me. He was very generous, and I loved all the people that I met at Railpace. But George and I, were very progressive, I would say, and we got tired of, you know, the small photos, the photos that we wanted to be able to use photos that would tell a story and stand on their own.
Think about what Real Pace is. It's they call it a news magazine, right? So right.
Yeah,
it's a little different from the railroad photography aficionado magazine that I guess is how I would describe Trackside, right?
Yeah. Actually, Trackside became, as best as I could describe it, and we are getting ready, right after the Christmas craziness, we are going to re-release a limited number of copies, which I will be posting. If you want to tune in on my Ken Karlowitz Facebook, you'll see a notification coming up around New Year's that we're going to be making these limited number of copies available, and when they're gone, they're gone. But I swear, each copy has a featured photographer in it. But not to get ahead of myself. So what happened was that George and I decided one day that what if we were to publish our own magazine, and it would just be all color photography, no advertising, no small photos, just killer shots. And we sent out a call for submissions, and we were getting stuff from, you know, Ron Johnson and, you know, Jeremy Plant and, you know, TJ Donahue, I think, was our first featured photographer. And what happened was the concept of the featured photographer in each issue just came about as a fluke. Like, this guy has so many amazing pictures. We can't just use two and three. Let's make this guy the featured photographer, and we'll blow him out.
Sure. Remember the old personal vision segments in CTC board? You ever look at that magazine?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, that's it. So, I don't know if you can hear that CSX horn blowing on the river line out the window, but it's...
Yeah, there. I heard a little something. That's a nice ambience to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So we started publishing the magazine, and we published, I think it was six issues. We published four a year. We got into the second year, and that is when the divorce occurred. But simultaneously, there was a drop in the economy. The economy took a dive. We were getting a lot of Chapter 11 notices. Just so for anybody who's not sure whatever happened, I met a guy Trackside not too long ago. He says, "Wow, I thought you were dead." He's making Mark Glucksman, you know, photographer out there. He's like, "Wow, Ken Karlowitz, nice to meet you." He goes, "I thought you had died." I'm like, no, we don't die. We just move on to different photographers. You know, they don't die off that young. They just move on to a different subject matter.
At least you were missed.
Yeah, I guess I might have been at least conspicuously absent for a little bit, but it was 27 years that I took a detour away from railroading, railroad photography, model railroading, and I really did. I started I guess it was a voyage of discovery into finding out who I was, what I was all about, and really getting in touch with the deepest, you know, and I don't mean to sound fruity or, you know, weird, but like the deepest parts of my own emotions. And I've always said, in order to realize your greatest light, you have to embrace your darkest shadow.
Mm. Okay?
And a lot of people are afraid to be alone. And I was actually in a relationship at the time. I was going to Vermont a lot and photographing. I was trying to get published in Vermont Life, and this is key. And I was shooting these, I was burning up boxes of slides, and I was getting all the color. But what was missing was I was not capturing a sense of place
in
my pictures. And Vermont Life magazine, if you looked at their photos and their some of their really outstanding photographers, the pictures would always capture a sense of place, you know, like if it was a picture in Waitsfield, Vermont, you know, with the girl walking down the dirt road in the twilight of the, you know, early evening, and the little cat was following her, beside her, walking behind her, and the rim lighting was lighting them, and the girl's carrying a pumpkin, and the cat's walking behind her. And the barn steep, the cupola of the barn is seen through the peak foliage in the distance. You know what I mean?
Is that the kind of thing that Norman Rockwell fully understood?
Exactly. Yeah. He captured the decisive moment. And
I used to have some times like that myself. There was a period of time, those post-divorce years, same kind of circumstance. And I used to go out west a lot, and I'd find myself out in the desert. And sometimes I'd be out in the desert for 2 or 3 days completely alone, sometimes a whole day where I didn't say a single word out loud. And someday I'm going to go back to those photos and see if they speak to me in any way that resembles what was actually going on at that time.
I bet you they will, Mike. You know why?
Yeah, be an interesting thing to see. Talking about maybe early 90s.
They say I had a studio with a guy in Haverstraw probably around the year 1999, which is when I got seriously into living a project. I was living in the studio. I was sleeping on the floor. I had my sleeping bag and my comforter, my quilt rolled up with my pillow. I'd shove it in every morning. I'd get up before my partner got into the office and shove it in the broom closet, and I was ready to go. But every night I would sleep outside, and I would listen to the trains going back and forth on the river line through Haverstraw, which you just heard. And I would write in my journal about who I photographed, who I met, what was I feeling, what I did. And
so is this in the middle of that 27-year hiatus from railroad photography?
Yeah. And what's interesting for most people who know how I do things, everything I do is probably since I'm, I don't know, 10, definitely 15. Everything I do is done with great intensity and focus and absolute determination to get where I want to go.
I call that,
right?
Ken Karlowitz experience.
Thank you. Oh, well, that sounds good to me. Here's the funny part. And this is in the for some people who haven't seen it, the video is on YouTube. It's called Sense of Place. If you check it out, it's about a 20-minute short documentary. I know you've seen it. There's another one called The Language of Light. And that's all about light and how it relates to photography, and more specifically, prototype photography as well as model photography. But what
happens? You've got clinics on that at some of the proto meets, also, haven't you?
Yeah, and that's probably like my continuing journey is to I taught karate when I was 17. I had a school. I've always since probably a teenager. I've always been some kind of a teacher. I taught kids photography for about 15 years. It's only about 6 years since I stopped teaching the kids. Had a phenomenal kids program. But going back to how I really became, I guess, the type of photographer that I am is, excuse me, there was an old farmer who had a brother. And the brother was, the farm has been here in Rockland for 100 years. It was called Smith's Farm. Came to find out one New Year's Eve, hey, did you hear this, Ken Karlowitz? You're a photographer, right? Yeah, well, this might be something for you. The Smith brothers, one of them's dying of cancer, and they're going to have to sell the farm. That was it. I was right on it. And that's when I hooked up with the guy that I mentioned, the gentleman I mentioned earlier, John Derniak, who I would literally pick up in the car, go to the bagel store, get the coffee and the bagel, and go to the farm. And we'd be out in the sleet and the fog and the snow. And John was in the twilight of his years. But what he saw in me, because he told his wife this, he told Rita, he said that I had everything you needed to be a great photographer. He said he has it's in him to do this. And I remember him coming to my first exhibition at Barnes & Noble over in Nanuet, New York, and he pulled his glasses down and looked over the top. Then he went to the next photo and he pulled the glasses down and looked over the top. He did that about 30 times, and he came back and shook his head and he goes, I know where you're going, but you didn't get there yet. So he goes, but you got to stay at it. And all of a sudden, one night I went to his house and I had shot some pictures, some black and white stuff. I was shooting Tri-X. Now, meanwhile, when I say I was away from rail photography, that means no scanner, I would call George Povall every once in a while if I found myself up in Washington County and somewhere down around Shushan. I'd cross the tracks and it would remind me of George and I'd call him, but you know, we weren't friends for many years. We didn't see each other.
But you'd go rail fanning, but not really be out there hitting it hard with the camera.
No, I wouldn't rail fan at all. I would be out there wandering around the back roads of Vermont and upstate New York, photographing landscapes,
everything,
bridges, farmers, farms, pastures, walking around in the briar.
So my question is, what brought you back? Like, how did you get back?
Well, it's funny. I just thought about this last night. Think about this. At this time of year, I mean, everybody's sending Priscilla and I pictures of, oh, look, Joe brought home a Christmas train thing to put around the tree, and we thought of Ken, you know? So what happened was there was this hobby store down in Tepan, and I drove by, and I see the neon sign in the window says trains, you know? And I go, let me just go in there, and I walked in, and I would go in every once in a while and just kind of look at, you know, the magazines and flip through them, you know, and then I put the thing back and I'd say, all right, well, thanks. You know, well, this night I picked up a copy of Great Model Railroads and there was actually a story in about Wayne Sittner in it. Okay. Hmm. And, Wayne asked me not to use his name. So that's all I'll say about his name.
Right.
No kidding aside. And I Googled Wayne and I looked him up and I saw what I saw in and I have to compliment him. What I saw in Wayne's modeling was like detail. Really loved, he's a great modeler.
Without being overdone.
Yeah, it wasn't gaudy. It was just real. It was textural. It was gritty. He used all kinds of things to make his scenery. Like he'd use twine. He used real sifted cinders. Actually, the cinders that everybody keeps asking about that I used in my Schoharie Junction scene, Wayne gave me a little container of these golden cinders, and I have since harvested my own. But what a huge difference! But I went up to, you know, we became friends with Wayne. Started going up to his house, and I called him the reluctant mentor. Okay. Cause like I kept telling him that, you know, how much I was getting, but he wasn't having that. He was going to be a mentor to me, but I know how to get stuff out of almost anywhere. You know, if there's something there, I'll get it.
So and are you saying that your connection with him and the rekindling of your interest in modeling also got you back out rail fanning?
Well, I wouldn't say that not at all. I would say that, the thing about Wayne was I started to see what was possible in model railroading and I started to see the level of detail that you could get, you know, from really taking your time and doing small areas at a time.
And how much of a time leap are we talking about between that period and then you deciding to build your own layout?
It was probably about, it was close to 3 years.
Okay.
Because I've only been back in the hobby now like 6 years, right?
Well, so, all of this caused me to think about how you and I met, you know? And the funny thing is, I think you ordered something off my website, right? Wasn't it like a road gate or something? And that was well before we met, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I find your website and you had the article on, you know, how you accidentally sprayed alcohol on the car and it got all faded. And then you were like, ooh, wow, look at this.
How do I
use
this?
Technique, right. And I ordered something. I ordered those laser cut little gates that you were making. And I don't know exactly how we actually met. I know I started.
I got a call from you at some point, or an email. I forget what it was, but it was well after you purchased that, and
probably calling you to find out how to put it together.
Well, didn't you lose it or something, and you wanted to replace it? I mean, I don't remember the exact circumstances.
I still have it. It's in my box with all my scratch building supplies.
Ah.
That one day when I slow down and stop getting distracted into all these other things like scanning and going out shooting again.
Don't wait till you slow down. You'll never get to it. You should get on it this winter while you have the time.
Yeah, I should make – you know what? I'll tell you what, I've got to build that gate, because now we have this, you know, this great story to go along with, like, hey, where'd you get that cool gate? And I can tell them, you know, this is how I met Mike Rose, you know?
I think you sent me some locomotives for sound installs.
Oh, well, then you got to include Mr. Confalone, because once I realized what he was doing, then I found out that you were the guy that did all the sound installs. And I said, well, whatever he's doing, I want. So
you probably saw a video of his or something.
I think it was something about Allagash that I saw online, and, you know.
And then that's how you ended up coming up here, because you thought, I'll go meet this guy and I'll pick up my engines, which I don't like having shipped.
Yep.
Okay.
That's it.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, man. You did that first install, and, it was like, okay, I'm good here. I've got some real trains. I remember putting John Bazine, my buddy John Bazine, did a couple of units for me in a couple of D&H cars. And I remember, I think I still have the video, which I'm going to post. All this stuff now is all going to come around full circle. But I used to put that thing on the track and just leave it sitting there idling. And I would just make a video of things sitting there. I was so entranced by the fact that there was real sound, you know, coming out of the unit.
When you do sound right, it changes everything, you know. And I think a lot of anybody who's had the ability to experience that, most of them will probably agree with that statement. Now, it would be remiss of me to not ask you to talk a little bit about your wonderful layout, because it's probably one of those layouts that got to the wonderful point way faster than any layout I've ever seen. Part of its size, part of its modeling intensity, part of its farming out the stuff that you couldn't care less about, like bench work and things like that. But why don't you just talk a little bit about how you got interested in this particular prototype and why you decided to model what you modeled, Mr. Susquehanna, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, before the Susquehanna, and when I was shooting color print film back in the days, I guess I saw an article on, I bought a custom painted GP9 in the Bluebird scheme from a guy named Bob Mahoney. All right. And the guys out there listening, you know, HO Custom Trains, Bob Mahoney, who I don't believe is any longer with us, but I bought this engine at a train show in Albany. I remember the day it arrived and I unpacked it. So that started me going up to East Deerfield and then subsequently over to Mechanicsville, which was closer. And I remember I was up there when the hump yard was still working. My son was very little. He's probably 2 or 3, and he's born in 79, so talking about 80, 81.
Right.
82, and I'm up there, and I'm looking at the service tracks, and I remember I was in love with the B&M. I started custom painting engines. Everything was B&M. B&M was everywhere. I had logos, like, all over the walls in the house. did a lot of painting. That was before, like, I would do the air hoses and the snow plows. But that was before, like, you were doing the lift rings on the top of the units and the grab irons, right?
Sure.
So
early super detailing.
And I'm going to post up some of the pictures of those units that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, but you know, so how did we get to, what was the question? How did I get back to, like,
So you have a D&H layout, and how did we morph into that, and how did you pick the particular okay. Section that you're modeling.
Okay, so what happened was, when the Susquehanna became designated operator of the, you know, the D&H, right? So they had the B-40-8s, you know, stomping up and down, you know, Beldon Hill. And so George Povow and I were up there for a couple of weeks shooting them, running back and forth in a four-unit set, you know. And I had never seen that area of New York State, and I fell in love with like Central Bridge. I remember shooting a picture. It's in that latest D&H book that Ben Martin and Jeffrey planted. Backlit, you know, sort of early evening, cross lit. Train is going north through Central Bridge when the freight house was still there. But I kind of fell in love with that topography and that line up there.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. So I don't know what happened. I mean, the Delaware and Hudson, I think just from looking at a lot of, railroad press, and I'll be honest, I think I've never thought about this, but I bet that it had a lot to do with Wayne's, modeling in his railroad, because he was, all the stuff that for the most part, he had Conrail and D&H in his article in Great Model Railroads. But so I started looking at D&H. I got Dominic Bourgeois's, books, and I just loved, what it was, is that I loved all the paint schemes of the fallen flags. And I realized, and John, I got to credit John Bezine with this, because I have a little bit of a problem sometimes focusing my energy, suffer from ADHD. So sometimes people are talking to me, they realize I'm like a bird. My head might flip around, might actually do a 360 and come back to you. But
squirrel.
I started to try to figure out, he's like, dude, you got to pick an era. You're gonna be all over the place. You can't have the sharks, and
you can't model everything.
You got to narrow it down. And he's like, go through the books and look at what you really like. So I started putting little post-its in the books, like, I love this, I love the lighting, or I love the weathering on the 401.
That's funny. All those D&H books, I've got post-its all over them too, because I was going through it trying to pick out things in my era, that were, you're right, because D&H changed so much so quickly that if you care about your era and, you want to be, as accurate as you'd like to be, you'd better know what was going on at a particular point in time, especially with that railroad.
Yeah, like the RS-36, the 5015, right? That thing went through like six, paint schemes in 7 years.
Right.
So, I love that scheme where, the thing had the huge D and H on the side of it, but that was gone by, I think, 77. So unless you're modeling like that one specific year, you're limited to and I tell my friend Howard Miller this all the time. Like, dude, you got to – come on. You got to pick an era. Yeah. I'm going to do it. No, you got to pick an era. And
good advice.
You know what I mean? I got another buddy over in Australia, Rod Clifton. He's another character. He wants every – he's like, well, I really like this one, mate. And I like that one. I'm like, listen, if you want to talk to me, we're going to have to nail you down to an era. Otherwise, I can't relate. Like, if you want – well,
the era drives everything. I mean, even on – our buddy Confalone's Freelance Railroad, he picked an era, and I think he modified it a little bit, which, we're all privy to do, but it basically determines many of the things that he does and the approaches that he takes. And if you didn't do that, it wouldn't have the feel of real that it does.
That's right. Because it gives it authenticity. Now, forget about scenery, forget about backdrops, forget about if the track runs or not. I'm talking about just putting the models out there and saying, okay, this is my fleet. I mean, if you got steam engines sitting out, my old friend Vic, I asked him one time, I was doing a little interview, and I said, what's your era? What era do you model? All eras, he said. I don't have an era. So he'd run, a steam engine with a stack. He'd run a Hudson with a stack train,
Well, from the standpoint of having fun,
yes,
good on him, right? It's not what I would personally define as prototype modeling.
Correct.
Which is a particular thing. And if you're interested in prototype modeling, great. And if you're not, that's great too. It just happens to be what I do and what we do.
And I would say this too, Mike, because I'm very aware of the conversation about prototype modeling, which is why I borrow Mike's Mike Confalone's slogan, which is, people ask me, so like, are you a prototype modeler? Nope, proto freelance. It's influenced by the prototype, but it's freelance. If you see something that, you know, a particular scene like Coble Skill, I mean, that's a classic, as Tony Custer would say, you know, LDE, layout design element.
Right.
I knew from the beginning, after seeing Coble Skill Cole, that like that would be, you know, if all I had was a loop of track and I had Coble Skill Cole and a siding, that was D&H.
But, sure. And, you know, it's the same way here. In other words, I have certain things that I call them signature scenes, you know, that that's what gives your layout a particular feel in time and place. And it doesn't mean that 100% of your layout can or should be that way, because let's face it, we're building it in a basement. But the more of that you can do, or the more of that you can emphasize, that's probably a better way to do it, because it's not quantity, it's quality. That's what sets things apart, I think, you know?
Some guys want that you come in there and you say, oh, there's the station at so-and-so, and there's the siding, and there's the lumber thing. I mean, like I was over to Harold Werthwein's layout this past weekend for the final operating session.
Yeah, I was unfamiliar with that layout, but boy, what a nice looking layout.
Phenomenal. I've been posting photos for the last 3 days of the Delaware division and of his railroad. But I mean, literally.
Did you know him personally, Ken?
I never met Harold, but I feel this it's not going to sound funny because it's true, is I felt like I knew Harold because I felt him. I felt his spirit all around me in the room when I was there on Sunday. And I could feel him in the scenes. I could feel him, you know, like any prolific artist, their spirit permeates their work, right?
It has to, yeah.
So a good art, you know, like my railroad, you cannot come in here and not feel, you know, my personality and like who I am. Like, why does this look the way it does? And going back to what you asked earlier, which is to tell you about my philosophy about, you know, building a railroad, was, you know, I was close to 60 years old. I came back to it after, you know, 27 years gone. I haven't been building, you know, whittling away all these years to make this railroad. And now I realize, you know,
it's some catching up to do.
Yeah, I realize, like, I want to be, you know, I always call myself the little brother of the group with you guys up there, because I'm like the newbie, right? But it's like, I look up to you guys. You guys have taught me, like, tons of stuff. You've mentored me, you've guided me, and you've influenced me. And I hope I have thrown some stuff back at you that charges you up. But
No question about it. That's what's nice about a compatible group, because you know, and that's what Crew Call is all about, right? That's why you're on the show, because we all interact together. We operate on each other's railroads. We help each other. We learn from each other. And the whole really is greater than the sum of its parts. It's a cliche, but I think that's what we have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's why, you know, I think that this hobby is best when we don't hold out in our basement. And when we don't put our hand up and say, nah, you know, I'm doing it how I'm doing it. And, you know, I don't want to look at what anybody else is doing. I want to do what I want to do. And, you know, there's another saying that says, we grow best when we're alone. That's about emotional growth. That's not about craft.
That's right.
If you want to be, I always remember this. If you want to, one of my professors told me this, if you want to be a great photographer, you have to look at a lot of great photography. If you want to be a great modeler, you have to study the great model railroaders. And here's the last one. This is a Ken Karlowitz one. If your railroad does not look enough like a real railroad, then you're not looking enough at a real railroad.
Oh, I agree completely.
Okay.
If you don't go look at the real thing, how can you model it? I mean,
you gotta channel it.
Some of it in books, but you're never going to. That's why I like to get down to my modeling area once a year. Didn't manage it this year just for circumstantial reasons, but I know I'll be back there because that's how you, I don't know, for me, that's, I just get that feel, you know.
You channel it. You
get it in my pores and without going there once in a while, you know, you could lose it. But listen, before we get too far afield, because I know we could talk about this particular interesting subject at length, and we probably will, let's just, would you consider your layout fully proto-modeling, or is it proto-freelance to a certain extent? Like, how would you characterize it?
All right, now, all you folks that are out there listening, you know I already answered that, but I'm going to do it again because he was...
I'm pinning you down.
He was thinking about the next question, so here it is. No, and it's not prototype modeling. It's it has a very, very strong flavor of the Delaware and Hudson. I'm talking to a guy named Bill Bibby, who has worked on as a conductor on the D&H for 40 years. We talked today for about an hour, almost 3 hours the other night. This man says that he loves what I'm doing because it brings him back through the years. He's not telling me, hey, wait a minute, you know, your agway at Central Bridge is not correct. No, he's too busy feeling what I've created. So my objective was to make you feel like you were up in upstate New York, surrounded by the hills, right? The Schoharie Valley, and watching Alcos and EMD power coming through all weathered up, you know, strings of cars, and that the texture, the light, the wooden structures, the rolling hill scenes and the backdrops that I have photographed, all of that comes together to make you feel like I've taken you away from Rockland County and I've taken you to here. You're going to go somewhere that I think nothing of jumping in the car and driving 2.5 hours. But I had my niece come here one night and she saw the old guy, Joe Cameron, out in front of the little yellow house. And she goes, and I told her the story of Joe Cameron, how he grew up in the house. She goes, can we, Theo, that means uncle in Spanish. She goes, can we go there? I want to meet him. I go, he doesn't really exist. I made him up. She's like, but the way you talked about him, like he was really real. I go, well, that's the documentary part. That's the storytelling part. Because everything, if you know how to feel the landscape, you could create it. And if you want to know more about feeling, you know, the thing that you want to replicate, you have to know it intimately. And the only way to know it intimately is to get out there in the morning, in the evening, in the snow, in the rain, in the sun, and feel it in all different situations. And then you'll be able to at least replicate it at whatever season, like Mike did in the mud season. I mean, he's, he knows that New England's thing intimately. And I've walked through enough weeds and shrubs and briar to know what all that texture looks and feels like. So that's why I think I can pull it off okay, you know?
Well, I think that, you know, when you continue to post pictures now on the group, you know, the discussion about your layout and your feelings about it, I think, you know, people can keep that in mind and it might help them, you know, see it in a different light. So I think that was, you know, that was worth pursuing.
Am I okay to mention my page, my D&H page?
Yeah, I guess.
All right, Mike. No. So we talked about
crew. Of course you are.
So just so you guys know, I have a page. It's called Delaware and Hudson Model Railroad. I have started to invite, personal friends who are very fine modelers to post there. It's really about my railroad, but I've got a bunch of guys that have now, Neil Schofield and Mark Roach and a bunch of guys, Justin, who have started to include some of their work up because it is called you know, Delaware and Hudson Model Railroads. So
that's easy to find on Facebook, right?
Easy to find on Facebook. And if not, you shoot me a note and I'll clarify whatever you need to have clarification on. But, you know, I'll post up some detailed stuff. And if any of your listeners want to see anything in particular, you know, shoot me a note and say, hey, why don't you post so-and-so on the crew call page, and I'll do some little vignettes. I like to post pictures in sequence of three. So you'll, some guys put, you know, you'll see the three and then there's 15 more behind that. I just want you to see the three I want you to see. And yep. Then I'll do another post.
Exactly.
It takes away when you, and I like to match them so that all the geometry works as a visual, as that one plate, so that it has a certain appeal in its own right. But anything anybody wants to see or any way I can be of help, don't hesitate to reach out.
All right. So one of the other things that you and I were talking about and we thought might be an interesting thing to explore a little further on the podcast would be my last op session and the decisions about waybills that kind of came out of that op session. So I'll just give you a little, give everybody a little bit of background on that. The first op session back in October, that was the first one after the addition was built. And I was basically just putting the layout back together, Humpty Dumpty wise here. And I wanted to make sure everything was going to work. And that was kind of the goal of that op session. What came out of that, I think, was the desire and the recognition that I could probably get a big hunk of the new material, which featured, ironically, a lot of the DNH, happening, you know, for the next op session. And I thought, well, I've got a few weeks here. Let's go for it. And somehow I managed to get the whole DNH Taylor yard and everything for DNH staging and the Conrail Taylor secondary from Pittston Junction all the way to Taylor up and running. So I was very excited about having that in action for the op session. Yep. So as you know, one of the things you have to do for an op session is to stage it, to get it ready for people to run trains there.
That's right.
And as I was starting to stage for this op session, the first thing I realized very quickly was that the ante was up, that it was orders of magnitude now different in terms of
routing cars and stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't want to say maybe, I don't know if difficulty is the right word and complexity has a bad connotation, but I designed this expansion to have more options, to have more flexibility so that you were doing different things at different op sessions. And as a matter of fact, the intention, I think, on my part was to have the op session itself run over two or three different segments so that by the time you get back to maybe the first segment, weeks and months have passed and it doesn't feel like you're doing the same old thing all the time, you know?
Yep.
So the way things are now, I had the need to plan. You know, we were using a switch list slash waybill kind of hybrid form that was designed so that if a train went from point A to point B, it had some cars for that destination. It was picking up some things at that destination and it was moving on. And all of that was just fine. But what happens now is you could have cars that are moving through two or three or sometimes four different destinations, handoffs from one major railroad to another, or from a major railroad to a short line to another major railroad. So I quickly realized, which should have been obvious to anybody, that this information about each car needed to travel with the car because that's what was happening.
Yep.
So I realized that this was going to be the last op session that I could use that sort of switch list format to do, because the minute everything was starting to come back to the now two different yards and four different staging yards, that it was just going to collapse under its own weight. So I took a serious look at Mike Confalone's waybill system.
Yep.
Because we're familiar with it, right? We operate on his layout and we know how to use it. At the time he designed it, he had a lot of interest in the routing of things coming onto the layout.
He loves that. He loves to tell me that there's, you know, that there's corn or there's soybeans.
Right.
The car weighs this much, and I wouldn't be using that much throttle because the car is empty. And, you know, it's hilarious because he'll pick up the car and he'll go, look, this thing is, you know, it's either loaded or it's empty, and what is the commodity? And he's very exacting with all that. I like that.
Well, I think he was a lot more interested in that at that time than he is now. He's a little more, a lot more relaxed about it. And I think his feeling is that if he were doing it again, he wouldn't get that detailed with it. And I said, you know, that's great because, in many ways, that's not really what I care about the most in running my railroad. I'm not as interested really in the details about the routing of what happens to the car before it gets onto my layout. I'm just not. What I'm concerned with is that car is coming out of staging, which represents out there.
Yep.
And it's going to come onto the layout, and it's going to do certain things, and then it needs to get off of the layout.
Right.
And what I want to be able to do is to make sure that all of that happens without me taking, you know, 15 hours to stage an op session. You know, that to me is like a disincentive to have an op session. I don't have the time nor the interest in doing it that way. So it had to be easy. So what I did was I took a look at my form, which functioned just fine for one car. And I thought, boy, you know, if I could just take a pair of scissors and cut this form into strips with each strip attached to the car, it would do what I want to do, because I don't want to reinvent the wheel here, you know?
Yep.
So then I thought, okay, all I need really is a waybill with that information on it. That is the same form factor that he was using, because I already had the little boxes, you know, to stuff them into.
Sure, yep.
But then I thought, then we started talking about it. You know, I started running it by some of the ops guys and making sure that all of the information that we were going to need to do this was indeed being captured. You know what I mean? Because you don't want to do all of this and go through all that effort and realize, oh man, I didn't think about X. You know what I mean? So it's such a big undertaking. It had to be right. So we vetted it pretty well. And, you know, I think most of Mike's cards, you know, he has printed them up on the computer entirely. So all of the information about the car and the destination and all of that, it's for the most part printed. Now he's been handwriting more and more because
it's all in the database also. So if he needs to, you know, put it all together for routing or to generate something out of the computer, is that a possibility?
Well, in his case, I don't think it is, you know what I mean? And that's part of the issue. But when I started looking at the issues of trying to do some kind of merge, you know, to take the information that I do have in a database and use it to print out all the cards with all the information in the right fields. And then when I realized I'd like to do this on a two-sided card, basically the difficulty made my head explode. And I'm in IT, you know what I mean? I could only do this if I had, you know, somebody write me a program to do it. And I know there's all kinds of things on the market, but again, that becomes how somebody else wants to do it and not necessarily how I want to do it.
What I like about you, Mike, it's always about exactly how you want to do it. And that's not a selfish thing. That's a very strong intention that you have of absolute knowing what you want and how you want it to function. That's great.
Well, and if I don't know it, I know enough to try to figure it out before I try to do something, right?
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, I took the form factor of Mike's card, simplified it down to all the information that I cared about on that sheet that we had been using. And I decided that I'd go to a print shop and have them print it up. And then we're just going to fill them out. In other words, for an op session, we were writing in the reporting marks, the car number, and the destination on the form anyway, right?
Right. So
we will do this once for all of these cars, and yeah, it's going to be a big undertaking. But it'll actually be easier than trying to, you know, print it up. And then once it's done, it's done. And I guess the thing that I didn't understand about Confalones, I don't even know if you know this, but, you know, I was trying to think, well, how will I take a car that is going to one place like Mahoopany, but then maybe another time send it to the ransom paper mill? And some card systems address that by having like a little thing in a pocket in the card that you can take out and put a different one in there. And I didn't want to go that route. That struck me as being a little more complex and maybe even clumsy than I wanted to deal with. So I was asking him about that, and he doesn't do that. He creates dedicated pools for each industry on his layout. And those cars are always assigned to that industry, so he doesn't have to worry about assigning them elsewhere.
Right.
And he creates the variety by just having enough cars in the pool that you're not always looking at the same car all the time.
Right, which, the Agway covered hopper doesn't have to keep running back and forth to the Agway. There's other, I mean, that's its pool routing, but it's not also going to the, over to a Franklin Feeds.
That's right.
Right? It's going to one consignee, and it's going back to wherever it's going to be reloaded or what have you, right?
Well, I don't know about you, but I didn't know that. So that to me shows you how effective it is, because I couldn't even tell that I was looking at cars in a pool on his layout. And I've operated up there like, you know, many, 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 many times. So yep. I never even noticed that fact. So the key is just having enough cars in the pool and swapping them out between sessions, and you get automatic variety there. So that greatly simplified what I was trying to do in terms of the info that needed to be on the card. So to make a long story short, I went to a local print shop, and for $33, they printed them up for me, and they're here. Actually, they're at my buddy Dave's house because he picked them up for me. But I gave them the little wooden box that they've got to fit into. They cut it to fit for me, so I didn't have to be there with a pair of scissors, you know, and printing them up on my on my laser. So basically, we're kind of good to go here. And in fact, Dave's coming over later this week. And the first thing we're going to do is we're just going to look at each consignee and pick one at a time and create the pools for that consignee. So I'm anxious to start that, because for me it is it's a big step, and it's also what will prevent me from moving on to my next obsession until that's done. You know, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You know, this thing has got to be all implemented, you know. So
yep.
When
is the next obsession, by the way?
Well, when we're done with the cards.
Oh, okay. So we're postponing. I thought you had a date for later in January.
I mean, before I realized this need.
Yes.
I think I was thinking, well, why not in January? That also seems to coincide with you being on the mend and ready to travel and all of that. But the honest answer is, now that I realize what I've got to do here, I honestly don't know how long it's going to take. Okay. And I'm hoping to have a lower pressure winter. So
yes,
it's going to take what it takes.
To have a lower pressure one. And you know what? Just so you know, everybody listening, you heard my formal request, because I've been going back and forth between you and Confalone about which system. Then I talked to Dave Ramos, and he's, we use this one over at Harold's or Tony's, or I would love to, since I operate with you guys fairly frequently when I'm in the mend, that I would like to learn this system. So you will have to, when I come up to help you do some things, I would love to be a student of this wonderful system.
I think it's gonna shock you that there's virtually nothing to learn.
Oh.
And the reason I say that is, you've operated here before. You never had any trouble following the instructions. The instructions are the same.
Great.
It's going to be very familiar. The form factor of handling the cards and dealing with them as on a train basis, it's going to feel very familiar from up at Mike's. You know what I mean? So my goal was not to be, you know, like I said, reinventing the wheel here, but just to kind of take the best elements that, and just have the minimal amount that enables us to do what we want, because I'm not interested in a clerk's job per se. You know what I mean? That's not,
right.
It's just not what I want to do on my model railroad. The old railroads used to do it with armies of these people that I don't have.
Yes. So
I don't want to be that guy, you know?
And you really don't want to be, I mean, you and I both run a business. We don't want to be bogged down, like scratching our head, like, you know, making it too much labor, mental intensity. I mean, we want to enjoy ourselves and operate and watch the trains roll through and make our switching moves, but you don't want it to be like a headbanger. You know, you don't
want
to.
That's right. Like, my philosophy has always been, for me personally, that if it's not fun, I'm not doing it right. The whole purpose of this is to enjoy it, right? So if I had created a scenario where every time I wanted to do an op session, I had this onerous chore ahead of me, like I said, that's a disincentive to even have an op session, right? So it had to be easy and simple. So think about it now. When I take cars, so at the end of the op session, the cars that are in staging, I'm going to be removing X amount of them from the layout, and they go into the A-line boxes.
Yep.
Well, when I pull them out of the staging, I'll have the cards right there. The cards will go right into the A-line boxes with the cards. So there's nothing to file. And for the consignees that are out on the layout, those cards are already sitting there in the boxes. All I have to do is go out there and if I want the car picked up in the next op session, just turn the card around. And then it all happens automatically. So I can do that in 10 minutes.
Nice.
So I really think that we seem to have thought it through. And like I say, I'm just dying to see how it works. You know what I mean? Because it would be bad if it didn't work, but I can't imagine why it wouldn't, you know?
Well, I'm looking forward to the next op session. I'm getting itchy to get on the road, and you know, I've had my leg injury here for a while. I drove 3 hours this past weekend, round trip to Harold's, and I was on my feet for 3 hours. So you know, that's pretty good.
And how did it go? You were fine?
I was great. I was photographing. Got a couple of photographic assignments coming up for a couple of the rail publications. Tony and Otto got me hooked up to, so I'm about ready to launch into a couple new endeavors here, and I've had an absolute blast just photographing Harold's railroad this past weekend, and I'm very glad
I bet we haven't seen half of it.
You've seen half of it. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are a lot of guys around, and I'm out there on crutches, so I'm trying to get out of everybody's way. But I hope that if all goes well, you will be seeing, more photographs.
Well, the thing I wanted to say is that, even though I may not be ready to operate for X amount of time, there's no obstacle to you're coming out and visiting. So don't feel like you need to wait for an op session to get you right over here.
Okay. That sounds like a great thing to ponder. And I'm ready. We're jonesing for a visit with the Confalones and the Roses. So I would say probably right after the holiday, we'll have to come up and have a little eggnog.
All right. Well, I'll leave everybody with a little bit of a teaser here. So, long-term listeners will possibly remember that way back when, and we must be going back a couple of years when all of this started, Scott and I were talking about my Ransom paper mill. And that poor project has been around the block I don't know how many times. It really has suffered from some bad luck and some circumstances. And I will say as a teaser that my buddy Jimmy Simmons kind of came out of nowhere. He's resurfaced, and we have been actively working on cutting that building finally in the correct format. It'll be an interesting story all to itself, and I think by next month when it's time for another podcast, I'll have more of the details. But it's quite a saga, so stay tuned on all of that, folks.
Mike, there's something I can say about you, is that every time you think the saga's over, there's a new one hatching.
Absolutely.
And I have no doubt there are many sagas to come, and I look forward to being there to observe you and see all your updates and your pursuits, and as I will inform you of mine. So
the saga continues. Well, thanks for being a guest, Ken. And like I said, something tells me we'll be picking this up at some point. You know, the crew called crew continues to grow, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Nope. Happy holidays to you, Mike, and to everybody out there listening. And I hope we can all share some eggnog at some point down the road.
Same here. And till next time, folks. Thanks a lot.